But first to Ian Dunt in the UK, columnist with iNews, co-host of the Origin Story podcast, and right now totally engrossed by the crisis at the BBC. Ian, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Ian, last Sunday, the Director General of the BBC, Tim Davey, and the Chief Executive of News, Deborah Turness, resigned. Do we yet know exactly why?
No. The mechanism, the series of events, is very confused, very mysterious, and very febrile, and is now sort of being tugged at by both sides. I'm simplifying here, but basically by a sort of liberal progressive side and a reactionary populist side, in order to justify their version of events and their assessment of what the BBC is like. But the fundamental moment that they left, either of their own accord or because they were forced out, is very unclear. The position on the sort of liberal side, the accusation, which essentially says that a kind of coup was raised against them within the BBC, is that members of the BBC board, and in particular a man called Robbie Gibb, who was placed there by Boris Johnson as prime minister and has worked as this kind of sort of the centre for the sort of right-wing sabotage within the BBC. He sits within the BBC but tries to destroy it, was responsible for forcing them out of position. The other view is just that they stepped down because of the accusations against the quality of BBC journalism were so severe that they felt that they couldn't stand by their position. We do not know which of those stories is correct.
At some stage, I presume, they're both going to sort of put out a statement, make some kind of explanation.
Yeah, you'd think so, wouldn't you?
Well, but
you
know, especially when you're running a press organisation.
I would have thought that makes them less likely to be transparent and clear-spoken. It's weird, you know, the history of the BBC is actually terrible for this sort of thing. I mean, that, you know, in the 80s, Milne, who was running the BBC at that point, was the director general at that stage, was forced out by Margaret Thatcher's choice, Marmaduke Hussey. And that, again, took place in exactly the same way. It was sort of like no one ever really found out what happened afterwards. You know, they'd write memoirs, you know, 5 years later and go like, well, actually, I called him in for a meeting after the board and sort of said it was time for him to pop off. Like, it's quite, I mean, it's actually unbelievable. They use license fee money. It's public money. You know, it is under a charter that is governed by Parliament democratically. And yet when it comes down to these really quite key decisions, it's very, very opaque the way that they're made at the BBC.
Well, look, let's go to what the accusations are against the BBC. Last year, the Panorama broadcast an episode called Trump, A Second Chance. And in it, and nobody seems to question this for a moment. In it, they spliced two quotes from Trump on the day of the storming of the Capitol. They spliced them together in a really quite outrageous way. And I'm wondering whether anybody until now has complained about that.
No. No, but then that's the BBC. Where, I mean, look, every time there's a scandal about the BBC, we had the same with Russell Brand's. You know, we lost an entire summer about a phone call that a comedian, Russell Brand, made to the uncle of a woman that he slept with as this sort of moment of moral depravity. I mean, again, hardly anyone had heard the thing when it first went out. The Iraq dossier, which really sort of decapitated the BBC during the Iraq war in 2003, that was about a news report that went out at 5:15 a.m. You know, no one ever really hears the original thing. It's about the coverage. So oddly enough, it's usually the right-wing press coverage of something, their outrage, brings it to a much larger audience, and then people hear it and they complain. Hardly anyone noticed at the time. I also want to be cautious about what happened here. You're right. We all know the speech. It's the Trump speech before the insurrection. And they took a quote from one bit and a quote from another bit that made it look like he was sort of like offering to lead the crowd. When in fact, that you know, they were separate. I mean, you and I both know journalistically, like you have to be really careful when you're taking excerpts. And yet there's two things you have to be careful of. First, you have to be careful is to show that you are taking excerpts, which you do, you know, in written copy by using the ellipsis, by using dot, dot, dot. But you do usually on screen by just flashing white for a moment so that you can see it's taken from two bits. They didn't do that. And the other bit is you have to be careful when you've extracted a bit of commentary to make it clear to the reader if you've changed, if the bits that you're using would change the meaning by virtue of the bit that was removed. They didn't do that. It's bad. It's very sloppy. It's dodgy. And it deserves probably a bit more than a slap on the wrist. certainly to take it to the point that's being taken now, which is that this would warrant the resignation of a director general, and that this can be used as a description of the whole of the BBC as biased and corrupt and part of fake news and all of that, is preposterous and absurd. But the moment itself was quite sloppy.
Who is Michael Prescott?
Excellent question, to which we all want to know the answer. He's a former right-wing journalist, used to work for The Times as a Murdoch guy, really, now runs a PR agency. He was brought in to advise the BBC on editorial by Robbie Gibb, who I mentioned earlier. So, you know, this figure brought in by Boris Johnson in order to try and sort of undermine the BBC from within, really. Boris Johnson did this to all sorts of institutions, including the Equality and Human Rights Commission. Wherever he could see a spot that he could just bring in a quite right-wing figure and insert them in, he would use his power to do that. That's what Robbie Gibb does. Robbie Gibb then brings in Prescott. Prescott writes this memo, basically says, You've messed up on this Trump quote. You're completely pro-trans. They're always obsessed with trans on the right wing of the culture war. That really doesn't stand up at all.
And poofs, they're also terribly worried about homosexuals, aren't they, as well?
Yeah, no, exactly.
And they should be. Honestly, and they should be, but yes.
It's a terrible danger to our society. But that always, I mean, it's always this flashing warning sight when the trans issue comes up, because it's always there somewhere. That's just completely wrong. The BBC has very, very robust debates on that issue. Very robust. And then he spoke about, you know, there were some instances where BBC Arabic had featured someone commenting who it ended up had a connection with Hamas. So again, this is the sort of thing that you can do with the BBC very effectively. And the reason you can do it is because of the sheer amount of content that it puts out. As I'm speaking to you, hundreds of hours of BBC content will have been made real because of so many channels, so many local news stations, so many national news stations just on radio alone. I mean, you're talking sort of six on national, obviously dozens and dozens on local. Then, you know, BBC World Service, the BBC News Channel on all the time, and then the broadcast stations and iPlayer. It's just churning out content. So you can write a report that says, look at this liberal bias and find three instances. Here's a Trump speech. You know, here's something that happened on BBC Arabic, and here's a trans report. But of course, if you were to take that as a data set compared to the output that the BBC puts out over the period he's looking at, years, it would look like specks of sand on the beach. And yet, because of the quantity of output, you can tell that story. And that's what he did in the memo. He told that story. And that memo now sits like a ticking bomb in the middle of the debate that is taking place.
But just on the BBC Arabic, you concede, but that may not be the word, but there have been problems there and that the BBC was addressing those problems.
Yeah, that's right. So it's more than once. I mean, it's on regular occasions they used commentators who they clearly hadn't done the proper checks with. So, I mean, they already had internal investigations into what was going on at BBC Arabic. But again, you would want some caution. You know, it's the trouble is they got into an awful lot of bother over a fundamentally semantic argument over Gaza, which was that they wouldn't call Hamas terrorists. They called them militants for some particular, you know, editorial code that they had, basically a sort of design code. Sort of said, well, we don't use that term for this kind of group. We only use it for officially prescribed groups and blah, blah, blah. The right went completely nuts over this, as if to say that all their coverage was innately anti-Israel. I mean, it is just an absurd position to put. Like, the BBC does often a pretty poor job on big ticket issues. On Israel, Gaza, it sort of did what it could. I mean, you know, as hard as it was to report on that area, it actually did a fairly good, fairly even-handed job in its coverage. But it's part of an attack by the right, which is to say that it is hopelessly pro-Palestinian, it is hopelessly pro-trans, it is hopelessly anti-Donald Trump, it is hopelessly anti-Brexit. I mean, you can imagine, you know, the position that they're trying to put across. And there were instances that they could use in BBC Arabic that helped to buttress that point.
I probably don't need to say to you, but this strategy is familiar to Australians, and the difficulty of populist politicians is also familiar to Australians, because the BBC is the most trusted news outlet in the UK. Is that not right? By a long way. And I understand it's the second most trusted news outlet in the United States.
That's correct as well.
And the ABC in Australia, of course, is by a long way the most trusted news source in Australia. The problem here for the people who are applauding what's going on in London at the moment is that the ideas that people trust don't seem to be the ideas that, say, the Daily Telegraph in London is anxious to promote. There's a bit of a gap there, isn't there?
Yeah, I think that there's there is a recognition on the populist right that objective values in journalism and culture at large are very dangerous to the project. So I think the attack on the BBC is very similar to the attack that you see on universities in the US, but you also see it in the UK, daily attacks on universities and on think tanks and scientific and historical institutions. You know, so, I mean, for instance, the National Trust, which, you know, owns a bunch of sort of old sort of mansion properties in the UK, historic properties, whenever they sort of have any kind of report on the use of funding around slavery for how these houses were maintained, which they feel they need to do, you know, as the custodians of those properties.
Because so many of them were built on slave money, yes.
On the money. Of course, exactly, yeah.
God's slave money. God's slave money led to some beautiful architecture, didn't it?
Yes.
But that's a subject for another day.
So on that basis, they're vigorously attacked. So you look at it and you think, well, okay, so there's a pattern here, right? And it's like, I mean, for instance, you know, we were hearing US journalists, pro-Trump journalists on the BBC this morning. I mean, the BBC loves taking on people who basically want to murder it, give their views. And they would sort of sit there and say, we're telling you the BBC is biased and my friend Donald Trump is going to take it out. And you think, like, you're a journalist. You're saying that it's your friend, Donald Trump, and you dare to accuse anyone else of bias. Because, of course, it is not really objectivity or lack of bias that they want. What they want is complete subservience to the right-wing populist viewpoint. Now, and those institutions which hold out then come under attack.
Now, Donald Trump, in a trademark way, is saying that if the BBC gives him personally money, he won't sue them. Do we know how much the payoff is supposed to be? And will it be paid, do you reckon?
I don't know the answer to that question. That's very difficult. Look, if it was UK libel, a bigger pardon, English and Welsh libel laws, he would have no hope at all. Because there's a sort of statute that basically says you've only got 1 year. I'm very, very aware of this as a journalist.
Yes, because after 1 year, we tend to know these rules.
Yeah, these are rules that I'm very familiar with. You know, after 1 year, you can't sue for libel. Because the argument for libel is that it damaged your reputation. If, you know, it's taken more than a year for you to notice that this thing has happened, by definition, it cannot have damaged your reputation, or else you would have heard of it already.
But there's more than time here, Ian. I mean, how damaged is the reputation of somebody who manages to be the President of the United States? I mean, yeah, well, it isn't standing, whatever the BBC has done to him isn't standing in the way of him being able to run the United States, I would have thought. But look.
Well, and we could go a step further than that, right? We could also say, how damaging is it, given that there were years preceding where he was extremely well documented to have carried out an attempt to subvert and undermine American democracy? That is a true thing that took place. We have to keep on telling ourselves, we're not going mad. You know, that is something that actually happened, even though now to say it out loud results in someone issuing legal threats. But he constructed a conspiracy theory, an extremist conspiracy theory, that he won the election, even though he, in fact, objectively and empirically lost it. Yep. He then spread that theory through social media and mainstream media channels. The crowd that acted that day did so and reported over and over again when they were asked questions during criminal proceedings that they were doing so, they believe, because Donald Trump was asking them to do it and that he would be there. They then tried to undermine American democracy themselves, inspired and motivated by the extremist conspiracy theory that he himself had invented and spread. So on that basis, the idea that after that series of events, he would be there. Yesterday, while he was threatening the BBC, he was, you know, protecting Rudy Giuliani, all the people that helped him try to undermine democracy. He protects those who actually covered the fact of what he did, come under sustained attack. And in fact, you know, facing bankruptcy if he was to get the legal the extent of the legal challenge for $1 billion that he claims to be looking for. So you do have to remind yourself of this stuff, or else you do feel like you are
going
mad.
Look, just in the 2 seconds we have left, could you report in on the celebrations in London, in and around Buckingham Palace, for the fabulous work the Crown did 50 years ago in Australia, sacking the Prime Minister Gough Whitlam? I mean, everybody's, you know, there are all the supporters out here say that the Governor General did nothing wrong whatever. So I presume there is fireworks, celebrations of some kind, perhaps editorials in the Daily Telegraph about the great work of the Crown.
Yeah, no, it's a special. We have it as a special bank holiday, and we all have barbecues and go surfing. So I hope that because I mean, I suppose, like, if it assists, you know, it is at least coming at a period where the royal family are having a bit of a rough old time of it over the Andrew.
Guess what? Princess Anne is out in Australia for the occasion. I mean, she isn't sort of. She's here. She's wearing a slouch hat. She looks fabulous. She's inspecting troops. It's tremendously exciting, but we have to stop. Oh, the people in the control room are making obscene gestures at me and telling me that this conversation has to stop. Ian, thank you once again for joining us on Late Night Live. I have been talking to Ian Dunt, columnist with iNews, co-host of the Origin Story podcast.